Support for NPR comes from ThinkMap, maker of the Visual Thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When trying to comprehend the universe and our place in it, do you turn to science, religion, both? Yesterday, we heard from evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, an atheist who finds science incompatible with a belief in God. Today, we hear from Francis Collins, a renowned geneticist who gave up atheism about 30 years ago when he was 27 and became an evangelical Christian. Collins headed the Human Genome Project, which in the year 2000 completed the mapping of the human genome, which includes all the DNA of our species. He's currently director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health. Earlier in his career, Collins and his team of researchers identified the genes for Huntington's disease, cystic fibrosis, and a form of adult leukemia. In his book, The Language of God, Collins explains why he believes in God and why his scientific research deepens his faith rather than challenges it. Francis Collins, welcome to Fresh Air. Some people think there's an inherent contradiction between being a scientist, which is an empirical pursuit that looks for quantifiable evidence, and being a person of faith, because faith relies on faith. as opposed to scientific, empirical, quantifiable evidence. You obviously don't find those two things in conflict. Why not?
There does seem to be a general understanding out there that somehow there ought to be a conflict between the scientific and the spiritual worldviews, but I don't find it to be the case. They're different ways of seeking answers to important questions. Science tries to understand how nature works and uses the tools to uncover exactly how atoms and molecules and life itself is put together, and it is the reliable way to understand those questions about nature. But science is unable to answer other critical questions like, why am I here? What's the meaning of life? Is there a God? What happens after we die? Are those not also incredibly important questions? Maybe the most important questions. So why would one want to limit oneself to just one part of this great human adventure into trying to seek answers? Science and spirit have different tools. They seek different kinds of answers to different kinds of questions. But for me, they're entirely complementary.
When you look at genetic material and when you were mapping the human genome, how did you see the intricacy of the genetic material that you were analyzing as being related to your belief in God?
Well, whether you're a believer or not, looking at the intricacy, the complexity of the human genome, our own DNA instruction book, has to give you a sense of awe as you page through letters A, C, T, and G, 3 billion of them, recognizing that this is the instruction book that's capable somehow of carrying out all of the steps that have to happen for a human being from a single-celled embryo to a very complex organism. You can't help but marvel. For someone who's a believer, as 40% of scientists are, it has an added feature, and that is that you're glimpsing God's creative genius. And in the process of uncovering this instruction book, maybe you're getting just a hint of what God's mind is all about, which is a pretty amazing thing to contemplate.
When President Clinton announced the completion of the Human Genome Mapping Project, and you were at his side, the president said, "Today we are learning the language in which God created life. We are gaining ever more awe for the complexity and beauty and the wonder of God's most divine and sacred gift." And I know you worked somewhat with Clinton's speechwriter on that, and then you said, "We have caught the first glimpse of our own instruction book previously known only to God." Did you think perhaps that even though you and President Clinton are people of faith, that it was maybe inappropriate to bring God into the kind of public announcement of the Human Genome Project's completion?
I'm sure there were some who might have thought that didn't quite fit, but, you know, at least in this country, most people do have a spiritual side. Most people are believers in some sort of a supernatural presence called God that is outside of nature and outside of science's ability to detect. It was a very significant moment, that morning in June 2000, where for the first time we announced the uncovering of this amazing instruction book, a book that you can think of as a book of history, a book of the parts list, if you will, of the human being, but also a book of medicine with great promise to do great things to try to understand and treat disease. At a moment like that, ought we not to stand back and be a little bit more than mechanical in our thinking? And I think it was, in fact, that same sense of awe that we all felt that made it seem appropriate to reflect upon this in a larger sense, beyond just what science had taught us about 3.1 billion letters of the code, into something more significant about what it means to be human and what, in fact, we humans have been searching for all of history in terms of whether there's something bigger than us that we might now just have caught a glimpse of.
When you say that the human genome is our instruction manual, what do you mean?
I think it's a pretty good metaphor. DNA is this information molecule. It's a particularly simple one in a certain way in that it only has four letters in its alphabet. They're actually four chemical bases, but it's the order of those letters, A, C, G, and T, that carries out all the instructions that we as human beings and every other organism too have to do. And it can be written out in a linear fashion. If you printed it out on regular font size and regular thickness of paper and piled the pages on top of each other, it would be as high as the Washington Monument. And you have all that information inside each cell of your body. So it's a very large book, but you can think of it as a book, and I think you're probably on the right track. And a misspelling somewhere in that book could cause you to fall ill with some problem. And your book and somebody else's book are not going to be identical, but they're going to be 99.9% the same, because that's how similar we humans are to each other. And I guess you could say we're still beginning readers. We're trying to figure out how to make sense of these 3.1 billion letters in our book in order to begin to apply it more effectively for medical purposes.
When you look at the genetic similarities between human beings and certain animals, which connections surprise you the most?
Well, it is pretty amazing when you can see the similarities in animals that we think of ourselves as being very far away from, even all the way down to yeast that we use to bake bread or make beer or bacteria. You can find stretches of DNA where the similarity, looking at the letters A, C, G, and T, it clearly indicates that these are related to each other and that they were descended from a common ancestor. So the startling ability of DNA information to draw these connections between organisms, which turns out to be vastly more powerful than the fossil record, I think took all of our breath away. Once you really have such a large amount of the information, you can begin to see those connections with incredible detail.
You know, yesterday on our show, Richard Dawkins made the case that science and God are not very compatible because science is something that is based on empirical evidence. Science is based on evidence, and religion is based on faith. For most people, faith in a supernatural being. So how do you reconcile the empiricism, the evidence that science requires, with the faith and sometimes supernatural belief of religion?
Well, Scripture in Hebrews says faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Evidence, interesting, right there in the definition. I think this is a common misconception, that faith is something you arrive at purely by emotion and not something where, in fact, one can assemble evidences that point in the direction of God's existence and make that more plausible than the denial of his existence. At least that's what I learned in my 20s.
What evidence would you put in that category?
I would certainly point to this knowledge of right and wrong that we humans uniquely have, which asks us to behave in certain ways that sometimes are an absolute scandal to evolution, because evolution only cares about propagating your DNA. What's that all about? That seems like a signpost. And of course, the evidence is about the amazing fine-tuning of the universe, which seems to have been put there for some purpose so that we could exist as beings of complex chemistry. Those seem to be crying out for an explanation. They're not proofs, don't get me wrong. But a scientist who says, well, science is sufficient to disprove God because we haven't caught him in our microscopes or our other means of measurements, is committing a logical fallacy. If God has any meaning, God is outside of nature, at least in part. Science is only really valid in investigating nature. So science is essentially forced to remain silent on the subject of whether God exists or not. And that is sometimes forgotten, I think, by the very strong atheistic viewpoints put forward by some scientists, particularly those working in the field of evolution. There's a wonderful parable that Arthur Eddington, the physicist, tells about a man who set out to determine what were all the creatures living in the bottom of the sea. And he had all these nets, and the net that he used the most had a mesh size of 3 inches. And he went down there and he scooped up all of these amazing creatures, and then he gave a big seminar about what he had found. And at the end of his seminar, he said, "And one thing I never expected, there are no creatures in the bottom of the sea that are smaller than 3 inches." Well, when science sets about to catch God, science is using a net that really doesn't have that capability. So if nothing is discovered, it's rather meaningless to say that science has managed to comment. Science really can't comment. If you're going to find the evidence for the existence of God, and if you're going to become a believer, science can perhaps help you a little bit in terms of certain pointers, but the real decision has to come from other perspectives, the spiritual ones. And I think, for me, having had this experience now over 30 years, of having the scientific and the spiritual worldview coexisting in my daily experience, it is a wonderfully complementary way to live one's life, and it answers questions and gives one comfort, and I wish it was more broadly shared.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Francis Collins. He is the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute, and he led the Human Genome Project from 1993 until 2003, when it completed mapping and sequencing human DNA. He's also written a book called The Language of God: A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. Has mapping the human genome bolstered your view that of evolution?
Absolutely. And this is one of the reasons I wrote this book called The Language of God, was to try to put forward what for me is a very comfortable and happy synthesis of being both a believer in God and also one who studies DNA and sees within it the absolutely incontrovertible evidence that Darwin's theory of evolution was correct in terms of the common descent of all living things from a common ancestor. There's been much disagreement, of course, about this, and great anxieties have been expended on the question of whether this is a correct theory, and particularly whether it can be compatible with interpretations of the Bible. From my perspective, God gave us the ability to look at the details of his creation. He gave us the ability with intelligence and with the instruments that the human mind has managed to put together to read out not only the letters of our own DNA book, but also that of many other organisms, including our closest relatives, the chimpanzee. When you look at that information and you see the precise similarities between our own DNA and that of other species, and particularly when you look at the details, not just the general similarity, which might after all be considered as use of common themes in multiple acts of special creation, you can't help but come to the conclusion that there is in fact a common ancestor of all living organisms on this planet, including ourselves. I have no trouble with that. As a believer who also looks to the Bible for answers to important questions, I don't think Genesis 1 was intended as a scientific textbook. I think it was intended to teach us something about who God is and who we are in relationship to him. And just as St. Augustine in 400 AD, studying Genesis 1 and 2, was left puzzled about exactly what was being described there, I think we all, if we're honest, have to be a bit puzzled too. And therefore, when you put together what we see in that description of creation with what God has given us a chance to learn through science, there's really no conflict. It was all his plan. He just carried it out using the tools of evolution.
Is that what you mean when you use the term theistic evolution to describe your belief?
Most scientists who are biologists who are also believers have come to this same kind of synthesis, often without knowing what name to put on it. I arrived at this same kind of conclusion after becoming a believer in my 20s and trying to figure out how that fit together with the science I was learning of genetics. It all suddenly made sense. Well, sure, if God had the intention of creating life, this wonderful diversity of life that we see all around us on this planet, and ourselves, special creatures with whom he could have fellowship, in whom he would imbue the soul and the knowledge of good and evil and the ability to practice free will, who are we to say that evolution was a way we wouldn't have chosen? It's an incredibly elegant way to achieve this.
My guest is Francis Collins, who directs the National Human Genome Research Institute. His memoir is called The Language of God. Yesterday, we heard from Richard Dawkins, a scientist and atheist. You'll be able to hear both of the interviews on our website, freshair.npr.org. We'll talk more with Francis Collins after a break. This is Fresh Air. I'm going to take a moment here to urge you to make a pledge to your station. On public radio, you can hear people reflecting out loud, in depth, from different perspectives, on issues like science and faith. If you want to make sure that there's a place on your radio dial for this kind of thoughtful reflection, the best thing to do would be to make a pledge to your station. Thank you so much. Let's get back to our interview with geneticist Francis Collins. He headed the Human Genome Project and has written a memoir called The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. You've urged your fellow Christian evangelicals to not put Christians in the position of having to reject either religion or science. You know, because for some Christian evangelicals, evolution is completely incompatible with Genesis, therefore evolution should not be taught in the schools. What kind of direct encounters have you had with Christians who are opposed to the teaching of evolution?
Well, my email address is fairly easy to find. so after publishing this book called The Language of God, which really does try to put forward a synthesis between science and faith, that argues that a literal interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2 is almost unsustainable when you look at the scientific evidence that's been accumulated from cosmology and geology and physics and chemistry and biology. I get responses. Most of the responses I have gotten have actually been very encouraging. Lots of people writing in to say, you know, I've been really troubled by what appears to be a big battle going on between science and faith, and they seem to be asking me to choose, and they both seem to have a lot to offer, and I'm so glad that somebody's standing up and saying, you know, these are compatible. You don't have to make a choice. You do need to be thoughtful about narrow interpretations of either one of these worldviews that are perhaps not required by the facts, but which, if attached to very tightly, may seem to exclude the other. I have to say, some of the harshest emails I have received have been from evangelical Christians who are deeply concerned about this particular position. And of course, I understand their sincerity. They have been, in many instances, told by their pastors or their parents or their schools that if you really start to accept the idea that evolution might be true, the end of that particular intellectual adventure is going to be the loss of your faith. And they don't want to lose their faith. Their faith is incredibly important to them, as mine is to me. And the specter of that kind of outcome is deeply distressing. And so they feel they must, almost as a badge of their true belief, resist any implications that evolution could be true. What a sad and unfortunate situation, particularly for young people who are caught in the midst of this battle between worldviews. I get many emails from those folks who are wrestling with what the real truth is. many of them feeling that they're going to have to make a choice, and some of them do, and some of them just decide to walk away from both science and faith because they can't see how they could really adhere to either one of these shrill, extreme perspectives that are being thrust upon them. I wish we could basically step back from this kind of tense situation. And it's not just the people on the religious side that are contributing to it. Some of my colleagues who are staunch atheists, I think, are creating at least as much trouble by saying that science rules out faith. But if we could stand back and say, what can you really say from these perspectives about the other point of view? You would quickly begin to see that there's a great deal of compatibility.
You say in your book that a literal reading of Genesis would lead to the complete collapse of the science of physics, chemistry, cosmology, geology, and biology. What do you mean?
Well, if you look at the evidence that comes to us from things like the rate at which galaxies are receding, or the radioactive dating of rocks, or the study of DNA and the relatedness of living beings, there is no way you can backtrack the origins of all this to a period 6,000 years ago, which is what an absolute literal reading of Genesis would require. You just can't tweak around the edges of the consequences of those scientific investigations to get to 6,000 years instead of 13.7 billion. You just can't do it. When it comes to the evangelical Christians, obviously Genesis 1 and 2 is a serious issue for them. I would just point out that the story of creation in the first two chapters of the Bible is actually two different stories. If you look at what's in Genesis 1 and then what's in Genesis 2, there are two descriptions of how humans came to be. And they're not entirely consistent with each other, which might be a tip-off that one should not assume that every single word there is intended to be a literal historic description.
Francis Collins is the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health and headed the Human Genome Project. His new book is called The Language of God. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, geneticist Francis Collins tells us why he gave up atheism to become an evangelical Christian. Collins headed the Human Genome Project and has written a memoir called The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Francis Collins, a scientist who makes the case for a belief in God in his memoir, The Language of God. Collins headed the Human Genome Project, which mapped the DNA of our species. He's now the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health. He gave up atheism about 30 years ago to become an evangelical Christian. Now, you write in your book that people will assume that your belief, your Christian belief, must have come about by rigorous religious upbringing, deeply instilled by family and culture, and thus inescapable in later life. But you say, that's not really my story. Your story is pretty fascinating. Your parents met in graduate school at Yale in 1931, and then they moved to an experimental community in West Virginia where they worked with Eleanor Roosevelt. Tell us something about this community and the work that they were doing.
Well, this was a fascinating chapter in their many-chaptered life. the community was called Arthurdale. You can still go there. There's a little museum that will tell the story of what happened. This was during the Depression, intensely difficult time for miners in West Virginia. And so the Roosevelts, as an experimental community, primarily led by Eleanor, put together this opportunity for miners to have a plot of land and a simple home that they would help build and basically try to make them self-sufficient. But they had to be trained in many things, including how to grow crops and harvest them, but also how to carry out certain skills like printing. And my father, as a teacher, went there to help run the school, which was both a school for the kids and a school for the adults. And in the process, being somebody with a mind that was open to many things, my father, a fairly accomplished violinist, fell in love with the traditional music of the mountains of West Virginia and became a folk song collector and no longer a violinist, but a fiddle player. This went on for two or three amazing years with many wonderful stories coming out of that. And then it got a little too hot politically. And somebody in Washington said, oh, that sounds like that might be a little bit too close to socialism. And suddenly the community was no longer allowed to be supported. And my parents moved on to the next chapter and the chapter after that. And they had many other interesting experiences, kind of doing the 60s thing before it was the 60s.
Yeah, like 30 years before. when you were growing up, your parents had a farm in the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, a 95-acre farm, no running water. What was their vision when you were growing up of what their life and your life should be?
My parents were completely captivated by learning new things and being engaged in community efforts, particularly in theater and in music. My father became a drama professor, my mother a playwright. They organized a summer theater in the Grove of Oak Trees up above our farmhouse, and that is now in its 55th consecutive season as a summer theater where many people turn out every year to see the productions. So I was surrounded by all kinds of fascinating people who had expertise in these various artistic endeavors, and I was taught at home by my mother, who was not convinced that the local schools would do a good job of keeping her four boys interested in the process of learning. And she wanted to be sure that they caught that kind of fever of the excitement of learning about new things. And she was incredibly good at that.
So you were homeschooled. Did she teach you at all about religion?
No. I learned many exciting things about language, about mathematics, a bit about science, not a lot, certainly about art and music and theater, but religion, as far as I can recall, really just didn't come up. It's not that it was in some way considered as a topic that was unfortunate or to be avoided. It just didn't come up. It didn't seem very relevant.
You know, in some ways, I'd say your parents probably raised you in the spirit of nonconformity because they seem so individualistic and so much in their kind of like alternative community and, you know, with their own kind of values a little bit apart from the mainstream of society. Did that give you a certain courage to kind of go your own way and be an atheist and then find faith and be a scientist with faith and not really care what other people have to say?
Absolutely. It was a great gift my parents gave me, was the confidence that if you searched out answers to questions, you could find them and you could attach yourself to those answers and you could go forward with them in a sense of having understood something. And that's not a gift that everybody gets. And yeah, that did put me in a position, I think, of being able to embrace truth wherever it came from, even if it didn't seem to be popular to other people at the time.
Now, you write that when you were a young man and starting in your studies of science, that reading Einstein reinforced your opinion that God didn't exist. What changed your mind?
Well, before I got interested in biology, I was interested in chemistry and physics. And I actually have a PhD in physical chemistry. And my project was very much to try to figure out new ways of describing how matter and energy work using mathematics. And I loved that. And I became very much of the opinion that anything that really mattered could be written down as an equation. Second-order differential equations were my favorite. But this, of course, put me in this mode of being rather reductionist, which is easy to do when you're young and you're excited about what science can do to describe how things work. And I probably also, for other reasons, found it convenient not to consider the possibility of God. God might have asked something of me, and I was quite happy not having anything asked of me at that point. So science around me and the people around me seemed to encourage the idea that there really wasn't anything except mathematics and chemistry and physics. It didn't occur to me to ask the question, why does mathematics work anyway, which is an interesting question. So I slipped into what was a pretty solid and maybe unfriendly even version of atheism, where anybody who mentioned something about God was likely to encounter a retort from me. What happened? Well, I changed my course in my professional career, finding that things were happening in biology that were pretty exciting. Recombinant DNA was just getting invented, and I realized I kind of had not fully appreciated the way in which that kind of science was about to explode into all kinds of opportunities that were going to have real benefits for humankind, and I wanted to be part of that. So I went to medical school. And I maintained my atheism for a couple of years in medical school, but then that third year, out there in the hospital wards, talking to patients who had terrible diseases, who were facing death, all of the hypotheticals became much more real about life and death and questions of God's existence. And I had to face up to the fact that I'd never really considered the evidence whether God existed or not. And as a scientist, that was something I should probably do.
So what did you do to set out to find evidence of God's existence?
Well, I tried to read the texts of various faiths to understand what they stood for, and I had a hard time getting through them. And ultimately, in frustration, I knocked on the door of a Methodist minister who lived on my street and asked him to please explain to me what it is that believers believe and why it makes any sense at all. And he smiled and answered a few questions and then took a book off his shelf and said, "You might want to read this, because this was written by an Oxford scholar who was an atheist and who was trying to shore up his atheism by making sure his arguments were correct, and ultimately had a somewhat different outcome. Why don't you have a look?" Well, the book was Mere Christianity, written by C.S. Lewis, the Oxford scholar best known for his works in Renaissance literature, but also probably even better known by most people as the author of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and many amazing books that define the reason that lies behind faith. Faith is not the opposite of reason, I learned. Faith is actually based quite squarely upon reason. What a revelation that was.
How did it change your life once you decided to be a person of faith and to practice Christianity?
Well, I was terrified it was going to change my life in all kinds of ways that I wouldn't know what to do with. I had this sense that, the next day God is going to call me to Africa or something like that, where I won't be ready and I won't even want to do it. And I might even become sort of this person with very little in the way of a sense of humor and all those things that you fear when you've not grown up in this culture and you're not quite sure what it's like. But actually, I felt this great peace. I didn't feel immediately a sense that I needed to change my approach to science. It seemed like this was a new opportunity to bring these together in ways that I wasn't quite sure how that would work. And ultimately, it took quite a number of years to begin to appreciate that synthesis. I felt a peace about questions that previously had no answers and things that would have really bugged me in terms of, well, did I get credit for this or that as a scientist? Suddenly didn't seem quite so important anymore. So it was a gradual sense of realization that I'd come into a new place and that I had this new relationship with God as an anchor that hadn't been there before.
Were your parents alive when you became a Christian?
Yes, my mother's still alive.
What was their reaction?
They were quite puzzled. They were respectful. They didn't try to talk me out of it. They made it pretty clear that this was not something they understood. Ultimately, many years later, my father became a Christian. He died 2 years ago. My mother's still trying to decide.
Did your father become a Christian because of your example?
I don't think so. I think he would have arrived there on his own as a result of many other experiences and people that he talked to and a maturing of his own sense of what life is all about and what death might be like. So I can't take credit for it, but it was a source of considerable joy when I realized that it happened.
My guest is Francis Collins, the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute. His memoir is called The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is Francis Collins. He's the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute. He led the Human Genome Project from 1993 until 2003, when it completed mapping and sequencing human DNA. He's also written a book called The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. We've been talking a lot about religion. Let's talk a little bit more about science. Now, you and your team isolated the genetic material, the genes for cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease, neurofibromatosis, and a type of adult leukemia. What do you hope that being able to, that having isolated the genes for certain inherited diseases will lead to?
Well, my hope is that this could really transform medicine in many ways. It would allow us, as we get more and more information about how each of us is at individual risks for future illness based upon DNA that we've inherited, to practice better prevention in a fashion that's not one size fits all, but is actually specific for that person. We clearly need to put more of our energies into keeping people healthy instead of spending vast sums of money on people in the ICU with diseases that maybe could have been prevented earlier. And this notion of using the study of the genome to do that more effectively is very compelling. But more than that, studying the genome is also going to tell us really how disease comes about with a precision that we didn't know before, and give us the chance to develop treatments that are therefore much more targeted towards the fundamental problem, and therefore more likely to work and less likely to have side effects. So both in terms of diagnostics, in terms of therapeutics, I think we will see over the course of the next 10 or 15 years a real transformation of medicine into a very rational, individualized approach that's going to have many benefits in keeping people healthy.
One way of trying to reverse inherited diseases is through embryonic stem cell research, but that is opposed for moral and religious reasons by some people who think that you're basically taking the genetic material of a possible, that could form a human being because it's embryonic, and destroying that embryo for scientific purposes. How do you, as a man of faith and a man of science, figure out where you stand on embryonic stem cell research?
It's a very complicated topic, and it's difficult to sum it up in a few quick sentences. I do think we should take with great seriousness the moral status of the human being, and that the union of a sperm and egg, which is how we all got started, is something not to treat lightly at all. At the same time, when there are hundreds of thousands of frozen embryos already sitting in freezers and in vitro fertilization clinics, with really no prospect that anything more than a few of those will ever be used for any purpose, it does seem hard to take a hard ethical stance that utilizing a few of those for research would be the wrong thing to do. And yet, I think that is the stance that many have taken. I actually think over the course of time, this problem may solve itself, because it will be the kind of stem cells that don't come from the union of sperm and egg that will be most useful. The ones I would like to have if I was developing Parkinson's disease would be stem cells that match me perfectly. And so the ability to do this thing called somatic cell nuclear transfer, where you take one of my skin cells and pass it through the experience of being bathed in the cytoplasm of an egg cell in just such a way to cause that cell to go back in time and suddenly be capable of making other types of cells like neurons that I might need, is a much more promising approach in the long term for medical benefit, and carries with it, in the view of most of us, a much lower sense of moral concern. Although, unfortunately, I think our language has tangled all of this up, and all of these things are referred to as embryos, even though they're fundamentally quite different.
Yeah, but the process that you just described, isn't that something that comes under the larger umbrella of cloning? And don't some people think that they're automatically against it because the word cloning is attached to it?
Well, there you have it. The words really have done a lot to cause this conversation to grind to a halt, haven't they? As soon as you say embryo or cloning, people immediately say, well, I'm against that. Sure, I'm against the idea of cloning an individual, that is, making a reproductive copy of somebody. We should not do that. There are all kinds of safety reasons, and there are all kinds of ethical and moral reasons why that ought to be off the table. But that is not the required outcome at all of this somatic cell nuclear transfer process. You only get there if you, in a diabolical way, decide you want to go there by implanting something in the uterus of a recipient female. That's the part that we ought to say is totally off limits. The idea, though, that you might be able to take someone's skin cell and turn it into a neuron that they need without in any way going on to this direction of reproductive cloning seems like something we ought to be able to talk about without having such an immediate knee-jerk reaction about, oh, no, that's bad, that's evil, that's something we shouldn't do. Because if you look at the details there, it's not clear what step along that pathway is one that really creates brand new ethical dilemmas.
And finally, what are you doing now at the National Human Genome Research Institute? Like, what, now that you've mapped the human genome, what research are you doing at the Institute?
Well, now the good stuff has started, because in a certain way that was building a foundation, reading out all those letters of the code. Now we get to apply it in fascinating and exciting ways to understand how it is that health or disease come about. And for me as a physician, this is the part we were waiting for. And so discoveries are happening all around us. This is going to be the year, for instance, where you're going to see an absolute outpouring of revelations about hereditary factors that predispose some people to cancer and others to diabetes and others to Alzheimer's and others to asthma, and most importantly, ways that we can prevent those things now that we have a better idea of what the cause is. So this is really what it was all about. The Human Genome Project was an incredible milestone. It was an incredible privilege to be at the helm of an effort of that historic significance, which I think people will talk about 1,000 years from now. But in terms of its practical implications for benefiting human health, for helping people who currently suffer from terrible diseases, this is the most important part. We're into it now. We have many exciting things just around the corner.
Francis Collins, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a real pleasure talking with you, Terry.
Francis Collins is the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health. His memoir is called The Language of God. Yesterday, we heard from scientist Richard Dawkins, who explained why he is an atheist. You can hear both interviews or download them as podcasts on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air. We often talk about religion on Fresh Air, asking people of different faiths, as well as atheists and agnostics, to reflect out loud about why they've chosen the paths they have and how it's affected their lives. For the past 2 days, we've spoken to scientists about science and faith and whether they're compatible. This is the kind of reflective atmosphere you've come to expect from public radio. Everything that makes public radio different from other stations happens because we're supported in a different way, listener support. I hope you'll support your station during this brief fundraising break. Thank you. As Time magazine reinvents itself for the internet age, the editors recently announced they'd be dropping some old features of the magazine's distinctive writing style. That set our linguist Jeff Nunberg to recall the age when Time's style was remaking journalism and the English language itself.
In its 84th year, Time magazine has just given itself a makeover, with a new look and revamped content. Along the way, the editors announced that they'll be getting rid of the last vestiges of the involuted syntax that used to be a stylistic signature of the mag. Died Charles Pretty Boy Floyd, desperado of gunshot wounds near East Liverpool, Ohio. Actually, it's been a long time since inverted sentences were prominent in Times reporting. If people remember that particular tick today, it's mostly via a famous line from a parody of Time that Wolcott Gibbs wrote in 1936, "Backwards ran sentences until reeled the mind." But there was a lot more to Time style than that, back when the magazine was transforming journalism with a new and compelling tone of voice. The style was originally the creation of Britton Haddon, who co-founded Time with Henry Luce in 1923. The two were right out of Yale, and the magazine's language was laced with the airs and affectations of a bright undergraduate. The vocabulary was a showy mix of the exotic, the folksy, and the contrived, anything that might suggest an arch detachment from its subject. Time popularized esoteric foreign words like the Hindi pundit and turned the Japanese-derived tycoon into a familiar word for a magnate. It adapted the Greek word kudos as a synonym for praise. Originally, the word meant simply glory. It revived archaic and dialect words like hustings, hornswoggle, passel, and scrivener. And it contributed a long list of breezy new coinings to the language, from early items like pinko, newshawk, socialite, and racketeer, to later terms like Disneyfication, echo freak, and televangelist. In Time style, people never walked. They sauntered, strode, shambled, ambled, or slouched. And they made their entries preceded by a retinue of Homeric epithets, sometimes lined up two or three deep. Gaunt, scraggle-haired President Eamon de Valera, burly but suave Benito Mussolini, slow-eyed, soft-spoken Generalissimo Francisco Franco. That language was aimed at turning the people Time wrote about into the stock characters of miniature B-movie melodramas, each with its setup, its angle, its twist, and final kicker. The template rarely varied. People often repeat the Count de Buffon's remark that the style is the man, but at Time, the style was the mag. It could boast a brilliant stable of writers. Its early alumni included Stephen Vincent Benet, James Agee, John O'Hara, and Archibald MacLeish. But they had to submit to an editorial process that extirpated any trace of individuality. To Time's critics, that process stood in for the magazine's pernicious influence on journalism in general. In 1957, Gary Wills said that Time's mass-produced style was creating a kind of newspeak by collectivizing language and thought. And Marshall McLuhan said that Time's style was a language in which nobody could tell the truth. Those concerns seem remote now. For one thing, Time's politics have softened since the days when liberal Democrats wouldn't let the magazine cross their doorstep. Nor does Time have the cultural importance it did in its early decades. Now it's just one more publication fighting for its life as its paper shrivels up from under it. And the magazine has long since abandoned the flash and brummagem of its early style, along with its impersonality. Time has been giving its writers credit for 40 years now, and the pronoun I is no longer a stranger to its pages. When we run across a bit of clever wordplay these days, we know who to thank for it. In a recent review, Richard Corliss described the display of buff male bodies in 300 as Homer eroticism. It's a gag that would have done credit to Time in its heyday, but it reads better with a byline under it than it would have as a product of an anonymous style machine. But much of Time style hasn't so much disappeared as it's been absorbed into the zero-degree communal language of modern journalism. I'm not thinking just of the punning headers or the descriptive leads that set the scene, as a thin rain fell on Washington last week. More important, Time shaped the pervasive tone of modern journalism, knowing, distant, superior, a little cynical. In the old days, critics sometimes professed to see an inconsistency between the cockiness and irreverence of Time's style and its editorial deference to success and power. One writer described the style as embodying an ethical schizophrenia. But that got it dead wrong. As Time used them, archness and irony were devices for accommodating and diminishing the more unpleasant realities of the world. Edmund Wilson once said that Time's style reduced human beings to mannequins. It gave the impression, he said, that all the pursuits past and present of the human race are rather an absurd little scandal about which you might find out some even nastier details if you met the editors of Time over cocktails. I don't know that Wilson would be that hard on Time itself today, but you wonder what he would have had to say about cable news.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chilog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menjivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The movie Borat has come out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, Sacha Baron Cohen steps out from behind his character of Borat and talks about creating him, making the Borat movie, and some of the crazy adventures he had along the way. Join us for the next Fresh Air. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When you think about our place in the universe, do you turn to science, religion, both? Yesterday, evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins told us why he's an atheist. Today we hear from Francis Collins, a scientist who used to be an atheist, but in his 20s became an evangelical Christian. Collins headed the Human Genome Project, which mapped all the DNA of our species. He's also identified the genes for Huntington's disease and cystic fibrosis. He's written a memoir called The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. We'll talk with him about his faith, his genetic research, and how they connect. More on faith and science coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.